This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. First called the People's Department by President Lincoln, the United States Department of Agriculture is a diverse and complex organization. From enhancing economic opportunities for agricultural producers, to protecting the nation's food supply, to improving nutrition and health, the USDA supports programs that touch the lives of all Americans every day. How does USDA assist rural communities? What does USDA do to promote the country's agricultural production and exports? What is the Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food initiative, and how does it seek to promote access to safe and nutritious foods? We'll explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Kathleen Merrigan, Deputy Secretary at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Welcome, Kathleen.
I am happy to be here.
Great. Before we delve into specific initiatives, perhaps you could provide us with a brief overview of the history and continuing evolution of USDA's mission.
Well, you sometimes see old engravings of the U.S. Capitol, and there are farm animals grazing in front of the U.S. Capitol. That's because all of that area where we now have the Smithsonian Museums that so many American families visit, that used to be all of USDA's research farm. And years later, after USDA began, we moved that out to Beltsville, Maryland. But USDA really is an old institution. It was created in 1862 by an act of Congress and signed into law by Abraham Lincoln, the president. And we refer to it as the People's Department. It's a wonderful place. It's a very big place. We have three big buildings right there on the Smithsonian Mall, but we also have offices around the country and around the world.
With such an expansive mission, would you give us a sense, and you kind of touched on it just now about its operational reach, what's the size of the number of FTEs in your organization, its footprint, and the budget?
Well, the budget is about $145 billion. What people don't realize is that nearly two-thirds of that budget is for nutrition assistance programs. So people think USDA, they think farmers, ranchers, but actually we do food stamps, which is a supplemental nutrition assistance program. We are involved in the school meals programs, the National School Lunch Program, for example. So really, the bulk of our money is going to nutrition assistance, but it's a large amount of money, $145 billion, at least now as we speak. Everyone knows there's a lot of budget cutting going on in D.C. Mm-hmm. We also have a hard time saying exactly how many FTEs we are because there are different ways of counting. There are state employees that we essentially fully fund. And so do you count them? Do they not count? We are somewhere in the range of 114,000 FTEs. We are the fifth largest employer in the federal government.
So could you tell us a little bit about your specific role as the deputy secretary? What are your specific responsibilities and duties?
Well, it's not a short list. As deputies are, they are alter egos to their secretaries. So I am there to advise, first and foremost, Secretary Vilsack on everything that comes before the department. Specifically, I am in charge of the budget process, budget formulation, tracking where the money goes, which is increasingly taking up time in this environment. I have a particular role in this administration to lead efforts on building local and regional food systems. Because of my background coming in, my interest, Secretary Vilsack asked me to lead an initiative. President Obama, one of the few things he talked about in agriculture when he was on the campaign trail was the need to invest more in local regional food systems. And so I've had great pleasure working in that, and also all the issues around childhood obesity, childhood hunger with the First Lady. So all of those issues are sort of my true loves.
So with that, and speaking of true loves, what are some of the challenges, maybe the top three challenges you face in your position, and how have you sought to address those challenges?
Well, time is not on our side, right? Coming in as a political appointee, I'm very cognizant of the sand running through the hourglass. I luckily had the experience of being an agency administrator the last couple of years of the Clinton administration. So, you know, I understood that you really have to set priorities. And so I guess that is a challenge, not only for me, but all senior executives with all the things that are pressing upon us. How do we really have laser focus and know how to manage our time to those priorities? I think it's a really challenging institution to manage, USDA, because of the breadth of what it does and the challenge of the disconnect of what Americans know about American agriculture, because less than 1% of Americans now have experience, direct experience being on the farm or the ranch. They don't really understand the broad mission of USDA. So we really have a sales job that we have to do both to the American people and to other policymakers here inside the Beltway.
I know you mentioned that you were an administrator under the last part of the Clinton administration. You also mentioned, at least you had experience on the Hill. I think you were instrumental in passing and authoring some legislation as well. Could you tell us a little bit more about your career path, and how did you begin your career, and what brought you to your current leadership role?
Well, I always knew I was interested in politics, so I started, my first job out of college was to run a state Senate race for a man who's now the congressman from the first congressional district in Massachusetts, John Oliver. So I worked in state legislature for a few years, went and got a master's in public policy in Texas, worked for the State Department of Agriculture there. No, it wasn't Commissioner Perry at the time. It was Commissioner Hightower, but I do have some Texas roots for that reason and interest in the department, the history over the years. I worked in the Senate Agriculture Committee for 6 years for Pat Leahy, who is chair, and went back to school on the eve of a Clinton victory in a senior position in the Senate staff. I went back to do my PhD, and some people thought that was a crazy career move, but one of the things that I found personally very valuable is to go back and forth between academia and the day-to-day grind in the policymaking world, because I think that going back and forth has made me a better practitioner.
Well, actually, what kind of skills do you need to do that? That's an interesting point, juxtaposing the practitioner versus the academic. And I'm just wondering, do you see yourself having to accentuate certain skills that you don't need in one area that you do need in the other?
I actually think I think both help you sharpen that same core skills that you need in terms of setting priorities, making very clear, cogent argument. I challenged all my students to take complex public policy issues and reduce them down to a 2-page memo, because that is what we trade in Washington, right? And if you get a memo, if you're lucky enough to get the president's attention on something, you're sending a memo into the Oval Office, you don't get 2 pages. It's less than that because of just the complexity of everything that he has to deal with. So really learning to research an issue. Very few things that we think about these days are new. There's so little that's new. And I really learned in academia that you really need to understand the origin of an idea, its evolution, understand, has this been tried before? How has it worked? So in some cases, maybe people think I'm a little pointy-headed for my current position, but ultimately, I think having that kind of instinct saves time and saves some costly mistakes.
I want to get a sense of the characteristics of an effective leader. Could you give us your sense of what those characteristics are, and how has it changed in an interconnected and networked world?
Well, it certainly has changed. I mean, I really learned that from my graduate students up at Tufts University, where I was at. I had the students who were the best and the brightest, you know, straight A, top scholars from their undergraduate institutions, really gung-ho students. They don't read newspapers. I mean, my husband and I, you hear the thump at the end of the driveway in the morning. We get the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post. I mean, I live for that. All of my students read online. they got their news in different ways through social media, maybe those late night talk shows. It's just really opened my eyes and realized that if I was going to lead an institution that not just had people of my generation, but younger people too, I was going to have to think differently. So I think all of us are challenged, but it's great opportunities. In this time of constrained budgets, we're doing a lot more with bringing people in through teleconferences. We've set up a number of sites at headquarters at USDA, for example, where we reach out to all of our state directors on one phone call to talk about issues on a regular basis. So we really can save money by investing in some of the technology. It's working quite well. What are the real challenges of leadership? What makes a good leader? Well, that's a big question. There's certainly libraries full of books that give you all the answers, right? For me, it's really trying to empower people around you, around me, to speak truth to power. I think that when you get up at these high ozone level type of jobs, people are very hesitant to say, Kathleen, you're wrong, mm-hmm. or Kathleen, this isn't. There's another way to look at this. And so, how do you engender a culture around you that people feel very comfortable bringing issues that are important and that may not sit well with you on first view? So I think that's really important leadership, a skill that I've really worked on and hopefully have succeeded in. I also think it's very important to empower people at various levels in the bureaucracy. We have this task force now we call Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food. And it's not all the people with the big name jobs at USDA. I basically said to agency administrators, I want the people who want to be there. Mm-hmm. I don't care what their rank is, what their background is. I want enthusiasm. I want people who are ready to add this to their current workload, not as a burden, but as a joy. And really, it's been a lot of fun. So I don't know. There are a lot of different leadership techniques. Undergrad, how I got in politics is I was mentored by James McGregor Burns, who wrote a very well-known book on leadership, and that was the actual title of it. And he talks about transactional leadership, transformative leadership. I mean, there are all these different kinds of models and books to read. But really, right now, I'm very focused on the younger generation, bringing them into USDA, bringing them into American agriculture, and trying to build excitement for them to do so.
Well, interestingly, you mentioned James McGregor Burns, but who else has influenced you from a leadership perspective?
Well, I had Barbara Jordan as a professor. Oh, really? Her powerful voice on ethics reverberates in my head to this very day. That was she was a really great mentor. I had Ray Marshall as a professor, former Secretary of Labor, who taught me the power of the two-page memo. So he is a really, really important mentor. I certainly have had a lot of politicians who have been incredibly important in shaping my views. Patrick Leahy, he was really big on empowering staff. He still is. He's, of course, the second most senior senator in the Congress. He would like to say, senators are merely constitutional impediments to their staff. We'd all joke, but what he would do is he wouldn't keep the staff shuttled in the background. He would bring me and my colleagues front and center and say, Kathleen did this, or Kathleen's the expert on this. And that didn't detract from his power. It didn't detract from his prestige as a senator. But he helped build a cadre of professionals that could go on and have careers based on their work in the Senate. I was really, really taken by his vision on that. John Oliver, the congressman in Western Mass, he taught me that he was a former physics professor, PhD, tough guy in terms of being really analytically 100%. And so he really taught me to cross my T's and dot my I's before stepping forward.
What is USDA doing to transform rural America and enhance its prosperity? We will ask Kathleen Merrigan, Deputy Secretary at USDA, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What are the 7 management imperatives all government executives need to know? How is DoD improving its business operations? What is FAA's Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextJet? How is New York City shaping a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and more efficient? And what about power, security, and leadership in the 21st century? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Kathleen Merrigan, Deputy Secretary at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So, Kathleen, the economic downturn has impacted many sectors and areas of the nation, including rural America. As a leading advocate of that area, what is USDA doing to transform rural America and enhance its prosperity? And more particularly, what are the pillars of success around that area?
Rural America has been in an economic freefall long before the rest of the economy. And when we came into this administration, Secretary Vilsack, a former two-term governor of Iowa, was very cognizant of the problems in rural America, the infrastructure needs, the lower incomes, the difficulty to access health care. And what we've seen over a period of time is very serious out-migration from rural America. At this point, less than 16% of Americans live in rural America. People on the farms, on the ranches, times have been tough. They work really hard. They get their kids to college. And then, as much as it pains them, they advise them not to come back to the farm. So we have a very serious problem here in aging in our farm base. The average age of farmers in this country is 57 years of age, but we have 30% of our farmers age 65 and older. I meet quite often farmers who are in their 80s still farming because they're not quite sure who to pass the farm on to. We're really at a tipping point. I guess that's the term everyone loves to use. But we are at a point where we really have to have a major transition on our rural landscape if we are going to continue to not only feed ourselves, but feed the world in many cases. We came into this administration saying, well, you can't do everything. We have to have some strategies. One strategy is broadband access. Most farms, there's a spouse who's working off the farm, and income is really important to keep that enterprise going. If people had more broadband access in rural America, that would help with telemedicine, it would help with rural schools, and it certainly would help with entrepreneurialism. Small businesses of all kinds could be created. And so we've really been focused on extending broadband. And of course, the Recovery Act, the stimulus dollars, went a long way helping us do that. We're very focused on local and regional food systems as a way of creating job opportunities in rural America. There is a fervor in this country around local and regional foods. Food trend that my friends in the retail food industry say they haven't seen anything like it in their lifetime. Well, that creates an opportunity. If we can help build some of that infrastructure that the smaller scale farmers could use to deliver local foods, that's a strategy that we're really high on. There's a lot of emphasis in this administration on green jobs, renewable energy specifically, a lot of investments, and we've heard the president talk about renewable energy. We have been talking about renewables well before people saw this most recent gas hike in the stations around the country. I know Americans are feeling that as they go off on their summer vacations, but this is a president, this is an administration who's been very, very focused on that. There's an energy cabinet, a subset of the cabinet that meets regularly to talk about issues around that. And we're also very excited about recreation opportunities in our national forests and parklands. All the different recreational activities around hunting and fishing and all of that, we think we can do better in terms of marshaling our natural resources to create those economic opportunities. And finally, we're really high on ecosystem markets. Now, this is sort of newfangled. They're not all up and running, but people who have observed what we've done with acid rain, wetlands, we've had basically a sort of a market system there where you can trade. We need to come up with ecosystem markets where farmers and ranchers and others get a benefit from using their resources in a way that helps overall ecosystem development. So those are sort of our focal areas in a rural development portfolio. But again, you know, coming myself from a small town, if you don't have access to health care, you don't have a library in town, you don't have off-farm income because there's no little main street to shop in, it doesn't matter how wonderful the farm economy is, people just don't want to live there. So when we talk about the farm safety net at USDA, we have to be talking about more than disaster assistance programs, because we've got a really bad drought in Texas, as we do now, or we have horrendous flooding in North Dakota, as we do now. It's more than just that farm product. At the end of the day, it's about the vitality in those rural communities and whether people are going to want to raise a family there.
Well, you did mention the agricultural safety net for farmers, ranchers, and landowners. Could we actually identify some of those programs, and how do they weave together to form what is, in a sense, a safety net? And how is the current economic fiscal realities we're dealing with impact these programs?
Well, time will tell on what the impact will be, because certainly farm programs have been in all the articles that we've read about in negotiations leading up to the act just passed by Congress, signed by the president, with the debt ceiling. And the super committee, I'm sure, will be discussing farm programs as well as other things in the federal government as they figure out how to muscle through current times. We have disaster assistance programs, a few different ones, so that if you have a situation where your livestock or your trees or your crops have been destroyed by severe weather, for example, there is a way that we can help out. There are also crop insurance programs. The taxpayers do subsidize crop insurance, so farmers purchase crop insurance, but it is somewhat subsidized. But it's very important to get them into the programs, because those programs work and they pay out well. And so we have those kind of programs. One of the things that people don't realize, and I would like to emphasize here, is that American agriculture is one of the few areas over the last five decades where we have seen a consistent trade surplus. So one of the things that we are really focused on, too, is building those export market opportunities. We're anticipating this year our exports of ag products to be somewhere between $130 to $140 billion, and the trade surplus is something like $44 billion. So all of these farm safety programs and subsidy of crop insurance is really down payment on what is overall a very important contribution to our national economy.
Well, Kathleen, you were a big proponent of the Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food initiative. Could you explain to us a little bit about this initiative? How does it facilitate the development of local and regional food systems and better connect consumers with local farms?
Well, the initiative is hard thing for people to understand, because it has no budget. It has no full-time staff. You can't come to USDA and visit the Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food office. So in some ways, that is sort of shattering people's typical concepts of is this a program? I say, no, it's not a program. It's a management initiative. I came into the department with the secretary asking me to move forward on local foods, and I found out that one of our programs that Congress specifically directed to invest in local foods hadn't done so, in part because they were confused about what constituted local foods. In part, they hadn't been pressed to do it. And so I realized that rather than creating something new, what I really needed to do was look across all of USDA programs and appropriated accounts and ask the question, are we doing the best we can do within current mandates to facilitate local and regional agriculture? And what I found out was the answer was clearly no. And so the initiative is really about educating across the department about what we're talking about when we're saying facilitate local and regional agriculture, figuring out how to get the different programs in a more synergistic working way. So, for example, I've got a team, a subcommittee called Local Meat. How's that for? Isn't that everyone wants to be on the Local Meat Committee? But anyhow, they're looking at issues around slaughter capacity. If you're a smaller farm and you want to add livestock into your system because that's important from a nutrient cycling viewpoint, maybe you don't have a place to bring your animals to slaughter because you're just not big enough, you're too far away. We've clarified some rules on investments and put some money on the table for mobile slaughter units, trailers basically that can come to the farm, that are food safety inspected, that are safe and people can slaughter the animals. Well, so the Food Safety Inspection Service, they're in charge of the rules for that. Rural Development has the funding to help fund those facilities. The Agricultural Marketing Service has a program on food hubs, and they can help connect it all so where people can vend their food. So what I found was when I came to the department, everyone was working. They're working hard, but in their own little shops, and there was nobody connecting the dots. And so I have a task force that meets every 2 weeks. And part of it is educating one another about what we do. We also bring some outsiders in to talk about what's going on in the countryside. We have a SharePoint, on the computer where people share their experiences. It's been really phenomenal, and people have been very, very excited about it across the countryside.
Oh, actually, turning to something you were instrumental in authoring, I believe, it was the Organic Foods Production Act of 1990, which required USDA to set standards that assured organically produced agricultural products. Would you tell us more about your efforts to strengthen the national organic program? And what does it mean to bring it into an era of enforcement and equivalency?
So, yes, when I first came in as deputy, I said that it was going to be the era of enforcement in the National Organic Program. Yes, I helped write the law in 1990. It was part of the Farm Bill. And then in the Clinton administration, I oversaw the agency where the rulemaking was completed. So I've had a very hands-on, detailed engagement with the National Organic Program. But in the last few years, I felt that people should know the rules by now. You never want to catch people unaware. It takes a while for people to understand rules, particularly complex rules, such as they are in the National Organic Program. But the days of saying, I just didn't know, are over. And the program hadn't gone after people in the way that I thought they should have. And so we really have put an emphasis on enforcement. We have actually had several legal cases in the course of this administration. And I think that there is a new faith in the National Organic Program. Now, part of it was the program was running on nickels and dimes. It's now not even quite a $10 million program. It's still very small in the scheme of what USDA does, but that's a very significant increase in the first couple of years of the Obama administration that's made a difference for the ability of the program staff to enforce the rules. We also are interested in equivalency. You mentioned that we signed our first equivalency agreement with the country of Canada. And what does that mean? It means that our products can trade across that border without a problem because we've essentially recognized Canada's standards and they recognize our standards as essentially equivalent. They may not be exactly the same, but they are sufficiently the same that we can let trade free flow. And we are hoping and working very hard to enact similar agreement with other parts of the world, particularly right now with the EU.
I'd like to turn to something you mentioned earlier, which is the importance of agricultural exports. Over the past 2 years, the exports have been very strong for a host of reasons. Would you outline your efforts at USDA to increase export opportunities for U.S. agriculture? And how does this fit into the National Export Initiative?
Well, we are very involved in the National Export Initiative. We are looking for ways to open up markets. We're very involved in conversations with countries over non-tariff trade barriers, challenging opposition that comes from other than scientific motivations. We have tactics and strategies vis-a-vis certain countries, but we do have target countries that we're working to expand trade in. I have 98 USDA offices in 76 countries. So most embassies around the world, they have an ag attaché there. Their purpose is to figure out market opportunities for U.S. agriculture. We have trade missions where we go off and we bring American companies to different countries and try to help them meet the kind of people they need and understand the systems in those countries so that they can export their product. And we've put ourselves on a pretty ambitious road. We'd like to get to $150 billion export market next year in 2012. And again, I think we're headed somewhere in the range of $130 billion this year. So if we can pull that off, my goodness, we have more than earned our keep.
I'd like to switch a little bit to a different topic, and it's a fairly new topic, as I understand it. It's agroforestry. First, could you tell us a little bit about what that is, and more particularly, what about the strategic framework and the goals that you folks at USDA have created around this area?
Agroforestry, it's my favorite topic. I'm so happy that you would ask about that. And really, my perspective on agroforestry comes, again, from being at Tufts and having students write papers on agricultural systems in other countries. What I got back was a lot of stuff about agroforestry, and it was something, frankly, I was very unfamiliar with because it's not very well practiced here in this country. Agroforestry is the intentional blending of agriculture and forestry to create integrated and sustainable land use systems, which in turn present opportunities that can benefit landowners and communities. Basically, it's another diversification technique a farmer can use on his operation to increase his bottom line. We do practice agroforestry in this country quite typically around riparian forests, buffers, windbreaks on farms, but opportunities in things like forest farming and alley cropping have been very underutilized. So what we're trying to do is lift up opportunities in agroforestry by using the bully pulpit, for one, because I think if I go to a lot of ag audiences in this country and I start talking about agroforestry, they'll be pulling out the dictionary. It's just something that we haven't tapped in this country, and I think it's a great opportunity.
What is USDA doing to cut costs and improve operational performance? We will ask Kathleen Merrigan, Deputy Secretary at USDA, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is FAA's Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen? How is the U.S. Department of Homeland Security turning its one DHS vision into reality? What is New York City doing to shape a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and more efficient? And how is the DoD improving its business operations? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Hear from FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt, DHS Undersecretary for Management Raphael Boris, New York City Deputy Mayor for Operations Stephen Goldsmith, and Dave Winogrand, Assistant Deputy Chief Management Officer at DOD. Professor Joseph Nye and General Anthony Zinni on power, security, and leadership in the 21st century, and seven management imperatives that government leaders should pursue to be successful in an era of fiscal constraint. All of this and so much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Kathleen Merrigan, Deputy Secretary at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Kathleen, foodborne illness is recognized as a significant public health problem in the U.S. According to the CDC, I understand 48 million people, or one out of every six Americans, get sick. 128,000 are hospitalized and 3,000 die each year. How is USDA working to ensure the safety of the U.S. food supply, and what initiatives are being pursued to improve it?
You're right. You've put out some pretty stark numbers. 3,000 people dying is just not acceptable. And this president, right at the beginning of the administration, established a food safety working group coordinating all of the federal departments that have food safety equities, chaired by my boss, Tom Vilsack, and Secretary Kathleen Sebelius. And there have been a number of things that have been outgrowths there. Basically, food safety is divided between the Food and Drug Administration and USDA. We do meat and poultry. They do everything else with the exception of eggs. We both do eggs. We do processed eggs, liquid eggs, those kind of things. And FDA does shell eggs. Are you confused? We also grade eggs, but that has nothing to do with food safety. So when you go in the supermarket, it says grade A eggs. Those are people in our marketing division, not in our food safety division. So one of the things that the food safety working group is trying to do is at least get people to understand how all of this works and question whether it all works as well as it could. We have things that we can do better, and we're working on a number of rule changes around our plants and how we do our business. Food safety, we had a major food safety bill that passed the Congress, but that's really focused primarily on FDA. But that's causing us a lot of work because it has a major impact on our farmers and ranchers, and so we're engaged with them and making sure they understand all of our equities. We have programs that incent wildlife. So in my conservation portfolio, I'm trying to pay farmers, cost share different things that they can do on their farm to attract wildlife. And in the FDA, they're like, what? We're trying to get rid of wildlife. I'm overstating. But you know what I mean? That the wildlife being in the farm creates additional challenges in food safety. So just sort of understanding how all of these programs marry up is really a phenomenal job. But there's stuff that the federal government does in food safety, yes, and we can do it better. But a whole lot of food safety also is what a consumer does with that food when he or she buys it at the store, how it's transported, how they deal with it in their own kitchen. And so one of the things that we've done this past year is we worked with the Ad Council, and we have a series of very, very clever, very hip ads on food safety that are just being launched now, trying to wake up the American consumer on issues around the temperature you cook your meat and poultry to, how you use cutting boards, washing plates and hands in between your produce and your meats. That sort of thing, I think, will also make a huge difference.
Right. So protecting the country's water supply is critical. It's the most critical environmental challenge of the 21st century. Would you elaborate on the role of farmers, ranchers, and landowners in protecting and enhancing water resources? And more particularly, what is USDA doing to make this an important challenge?
People might be surprised to know that 70% of land in the lower 48 is in private hands. And a lot of that land is in rural America and in the hands of farmers and ranchers. And so it's very important that we work with these folk on these private working lands to make sure that they're doing the best they can do in terms of our conservation goals. And so we have a number of programs that USDA where we cost share with farmers to have them do certain things that might be a buffer by a stream, so that prevents nutrient runoff, and we'll cost share that practice, and maybe putting up a fence to keep livestock out of that stream, we might cost share that practice. So we have a lot of different things that we're doing there to help. Our forests, our farms, our ranches, about 87% of the water that we drink is interacting with farms, forests at some point along the way. So it's so, so critical that we get it right. And that's why these conservation programs that we have, that USDA runs, they're so important.
So switching gears a bit away from the programming area and more to the organizational area, given the significant fiscal and economic pressures that we're under, leadership in your organization has embarked on wide cost-cutting efforts. Would you tell us more about these efforts and how you're trying to realize savings?
We have been doing a lot of things. One of our big focal areas has been IT. I think we'll be the first in the federal family to have a one email system. We have a huge amount of our work already up in the cloud. So there's been a lot of effort there. I have a great OCIO in the House, Chris Smith, and his team doing fantastic work. As great as they're doing, there's still challenges. One of the things that we were recently talking about is something like we have 800-plus wireless contracts at USDA. And they're all different and different deals. And so there's just when you have a bureaucracy with 19 agencies and all different siloed approaches to IT and a number of things, it's very difficult to get a handle on it and reform it. But we are doing that. We have really focused on increasing the contracting with small businesses. USDA is in, if not the top, it's in the top three of the federal government in terms of vending with small businesses and working to get small farmers, too, involved in food procurement. So that's a big initiative that the White House has been pushing that we've really focused in on. Does it save money? Well, it doesn't necessarily save money, but it's using our money in a way that has great meaning in society. We're really focused on trying to improve improper payments. Maybe that sounds funny to say improve improper, but improper payments is a problem across federal government. And with our Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, the SNAP program, with our school meals programs, we can always do better. We've had some management reforms in that area where we're connecting people's eligibility for one thing with another thing, so we don't have to burden people with so much paperwork, which also increases the potential for error. We have really challenged all our agencies to reduce travel costs, putting in a video conferencing capacity, making sure a new computer has Skype ability. That's been very important. But even so, we've asked all agencies to cut back on their travel by about 20%. And we keep track of that every month. We get new data in, the secretary and I look at that. So there's all kinds of things going on, but we have just scratched the surface. And clearly, in these next couple of years, it's going to be pretty challenging. And we have asked all hands on deck approach for everyone to offer up their ideas. We're looking at all kinds of things right now. It's preliminary, so I'm really not ready to say. But one of the things that we found in trying to figure out where our money is going, where are we in any particular day in the month in terms of our outlays, is that with 19 agencies, again, we have a lot of different accounting systems, and it's kind of hard to crunch the numbers. So that's something that we're working on, trying to get more consistency. The way we do contracting is also fairly inconsistent around the department. We're really working on that. We've really been focusing on everyone pitching in with their ideas. Now, the president set up this SAVE Award, where people are supposed to come up with an idea. How do you save money? A Forest Service employee was one of the finalists there. Her idea of just watching her daily grind, she saw that when they took samples, put it in a FedEx box to zoom off to the lab, well, that made sense because they needed immediate results. But then those sampling boxes would be sent back to the office via similar route, via FedEx. And that could have gone regular mail, and it would have cost a lot less money. She put that idea forward. It was one of the top vote-getters. We implemented it right away. Now, it didn't save a billion or a trillion, the kind of dollars that we're talking about in the aggregate here in Washington, but it saved $100,000. How many employees have an idea like that? I think a lot of them. And I think everyone's rolling up their sleeves right now, pitching in. So we have certainly been watching what's going on, understanding where this is all going. And last year, I got very involved in understanding the VERA and VSIP authorities that the federal government has through the Office of Personnel Management. And I'm sure most people listening understand what those are. VERA is your early out. VSIP is an incented buyout for people who are already retirement eligible. My first meeting with Secretary Vilsack before President Obama won the election, but we were feeling pretty confident, I shared with him the retirement data for USDA, which is no different from the rest of the federal government. It was OPM data I'd collected and analyzed for particularly for USDA, but it showed that in the Obama administration, the first 4-5 years, 50% of USDA's employees would become retirement eligible. And before the economic downturn, OPM's projection was half of them would take that retirement. Well, of course, now with the market as it is, people are very hesitant. But still, as we go into dark budget times, my greatest desire is to avoid a reduction in force RIF, because I have read those rules. They give no flexibility, and nobody feels confident and secure in their job. And I'm just worried that we get in that situation, it really demotivates the whole enterprise and makes it very difficult to get work done. So I've been very aggressive on the VERA and VSIP authorities. We had a USDA-wide VERA offering in this fiscal year. Our paperwork that went to OPM projected somewhere around 300 people would take advantage of that. We've had over 1,000 applications so far. We have offered VSIP in 4 agencies, 3 because of elimination of earmarks in the FY11 appropriations bill, 1 agency because of some reorganization they were doing. The decisions are still being made there. not perhaps as much uptake as I would like. But going into the next fiscal year, I want to have a USDA package through OPM, through OMB, so we're ready to make those offerings as soon as the new fiscal year begins, because people need to take advantage of those opportunities early in the fiscal year if it's going to have any budget savings in the long run.
The GPRA Modernization Act of 2010 codifies the statute, the role of the federal department's chief operating officer, which is primarily, as I understand it, at the deputy secretary level. Would you tell us about that role and how the act has changed the way you folks manage and operate?
I don't think it's changed us at all. And I can't speak for other departments, but historically at USDA, with the deputy being the person overseeing the budget, there has been a lot of that day-to-day chief operating officer role. I have a boss, Tom Vilsack, who's a very hands-on manager. So maybe I'm a little less so than other deputies, actually. I consider myself a hybrid. I also go out on the road quite a bit, dealing with our field staff and various constituent groups around the country. So we are deputy and secretary. We share some roles, actually. But I think there is a new expectation at the White House after passing this act that we'll be going in for quarterly reporting on a number of things like high-performance priority goals. So it's really, I think, for my vantage point, USDA, more of a way that they're going to be holding our feet to the fire on management reforms. But internally, how we work at USDA, probably not a lot of difference at all.
So the next reauthorization of the Farm Bill is, I think it's set for 2012. There's been movement and discussion trying to shape possible content. Would you highlight some of those key areas and topics that may be in the next Farm Bill?
It's a crazy, crazy Farm Bill season. I've never seen anything like it because you have the debt ceiling effort. You've got, you know, we're at the cusp of finishing an FY12 bill in agriculture, I believe. We're supposed to have our FY13 paperwork into OMB in September. And then you throw a farm bill in the mix. Wow, it is overwhelming. And we don't have a sense of what that farm bill shape would be. Normally at this time of the season, in farm bill season, that is, I think of farm bill seasons, you would have marker bills out there. You would have a sense of how certain titles would be shaping up. Because of so much uncertainty in the budget scene, we don't have that this year. The secretary has gone out and he has put two stakes in the ground. One, he says, we need to have an expanded notion of this farm safety net. It's not just about our disaster programs, our conservation programs, even our crop insurance programs. It's about investing in rural America and making rural America a place where people want to raise families, where they want to farm, where they want to be. That is his vision, and we'll be talking a lot about rural development when we get into that farm bill debate. The second area he's talked about, and I feel as strongly about this as anything, is a need to increase the tools in our toolbox to bring in beginning farmers. As an earlier segment, I talked about farmers, average age 57, 30%, 65 years of age and older. We need to bring in a new crop, if you will, of farmers and ranchers around the countryside. And the capital costs of being in American agriculture are huge. Right now, prime farmland in Iowa is about $6,000 an acre. Mm-hmm. In Hawaii, you know, millions of dollars for the right acre. I mean, it is just crazy. A combine, probably $250,000. The average farmer in America has nearly $1 million in assets, and that's just basically to do the really minimal work that requires American agriculture. So a young person coming in, particularly a young person who doesn't have a farm in the family, how do you do that? So at the same time, I've got this fervor, this excitement about American agriculture. Young people, especially because of the local regional food scene, really interested again, wanting to reconnect, wanting to get their hands in the soil, saying maybe a career in agriculture is for me. At the same time, I've got this incredibly capital-intensive enterprise, and I don't know how to crosswalk them in. So we'll be talking about that as we approach the Farm Bill.
Well, what does the future hold for the U.S. Department of Agriculture? We will ask Kathleen Merrigan, Deputy Secretary at USDA, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Each edition of the Business of Government magazine has as its focus the core mission of the IBM Center, connecting research to practice as a means to improve public management. We do this by bringing together insights and perspectives blended with an equal measure of practicality and reflection from an array of government leaders, public managers, thinkers, and practitioners. Hi, I'm Michael Keegan, managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. In an era of fiscal contraction, today's leaders face unique challenges that present many difficult choices. It is a period that, while imposing many constraints, simultaneously confers as many opportunities to make a difference, introduce new ways of managing, explore pragmatic approaches, and pursue management imperatives that help government leaders perform in an ever-challenging, complex environment. In our latest edition, we bring you conversations with FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt, outlining the Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen. Raphael Boris, DHS Undersecretary for Management, discusses how the department is turning its one DHS vision into a reality. Stephen Goldsmith, Deputy Mayor for Operations for the City of New York, discusses how the city is shaping a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and efficient. We offer perspectives on power, security, and leadership in the 21st century from Professor Joseph S. Nye, Jr. and General Anthony Zinni, former commander of the U.S. Central Command. Our forum presents seven management imperatives that government leaders must pursue to be successful in this new environment. All of this and so much more in the Spring-Summer 2011 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Kathleen Merrigan, Deputy Secretary at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Kathleen, I have the pleasure to talk to most of my guests about the use of collaboration and partnerships among agencies and private sector to achieve mission results. How are you at USDA leveraging partnerships to improve operations?
USDA just entered into a memorandum of understanding with the philanthropic community. We really do need to leverage money in these tight times. And so Secretary Vilsack has been in conversation, as have I, with the foundation community saying, how do we pull our monies together, set priorities? At the same time, we are just launching the Rural Council. Mm-hmm. The president will be on a bus in the Midwest talking about rural America. Cabinet officials will be there. Secretary Vilsack chairs that council, but we'll have other members of the cabinet there talking about what their equities are, what they can put on the table, whether it's more investments in short rail and the Department of Transportation, whether it's the Sustainable Communities Program that Housing and Urban Development oversees, whether it's Secretary Duncan and the Department of Education talking about how we are sure to have school teachers in rural America to help those young families who want to settle there. So we are talking about leveraging, too, across the federal family right now.
What are you doing to promote the next generation of farmers, ranchers, and agricultural stewards in the U.S.?
Well, we have a number of programs. We have a beginning farmer training program. We have a program with our Conservation Reserve program, which is a land retirement program where a farmer, if he wants to pull his land out of that, can get a financial boost if he hands it over to a beginning farmer. But again, we don't have enough tools in our toolkit to really have that transfer of land to the next generation the way that we need. We have a very interesting challenge, too, right now. People may have seen our new food icon, myplate.gov. It's sort of a replacement for the food guide pyramid. It's a food prompt. It's supposed to make you think about what you eat with obesity, as it is in this country. One in three children born after the year 2000, if food trends don't change, they're going to develop type 2 diabetes in their lifetime. We've got to do something. So this food icon comes out in a really great time. And one of the things it's supposed to prompt us to think is eating half a plate of fruits and vegetables. So that's great. But people are not nearly there in eating half a plate of fruits and vegetables. How are we going to get people to grow that food, have that available? And one of the interesting things is opportunities in urban agriculture, peri-urban agriculture, vertical farming, where people are actually constructing up and buildings. There are a lot of different ways of doing agriculture that's going to require additional research investment, good old American ingenuity, and really an openness to change.
So what are some of the major opportunities and challenges you see your organization